Welcome to the Visual Impact Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights from the world of filmmaking. I'm Rob Newton, and today we are talking to award-winning cinematographer Kate Reid, BSc. We cover her early career working on Batman Begins, Thunderbirds, and Brothers Grimm, before focusing on Kate's work on Hannah, Marcella, Prest, and Game of Thrones. Kate studied cinematography at the UK's National Film and Television School, where she was the recipient of the Freddie Francis Scholarship. Her films have screened in competition at international festivals, and she won the Underwire Award for Best Cinematographer in 2015 with Nazi Boots. Kate, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem at all. You've obviously worked on some very successful and high-profile productions. You know, we talked about Hannah and Marcella and Press, which, you know, I'd like to explore later in the podcast. And, of course, you won the Underwire Award for Best Cinematographer for Nazi Boots in 2015. I watched it, actually, again the other day, and it's quite a harrowing story, isn't it? Very moving, considering it's quite a short film, I was really impressed with it. Could you just tell us a little bit of the background to how you came to shoot it?
Yes, I was. I've worked with Debs Patton before, and Debs was who was the director and also sort of adapted the story. And the story is of Holocaust survivor Janine Weber, and Debs worked with her to, you know, take her story and make it into a script, a short 5-minute script, which was commissioned by the Holocaust Memorial Day. Where they approach various artists to use different mediums to tell Holocaust survivor stories. It was because I'd worked with Debs before that I came to be involved with the project. And it's, you know, it's a very powerful short film. It's just sort of less than 5 minutes. And I think that's just all down to the subject matter. And it was a really, really nice short film, a lovely team of people doing it. You know, often with shorts, they're made for love, and this definitely was one of those. You know, no one was paid to do it, and it was just a few days, I think just almost before Christmas, so it was pretty chilly, but it was a great experience doing it. And you know, we shot with some very nice lenses. Panavision and Panelux helped us out with the kit, we were really fortunate that so many people came on board and were up for giving their time and you know, and gear and other contributions to be able to make it.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, the point of view of the child underneath the bed and looking at, you know, that sort of a horizontal split, and you could see the boots and everything. It was, I thought it was very, you know, it really engaged you, and you could feel sort of the oppressive nature of the whole piece, I think.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah,
all to Debs.
Yeah, no, it was very, very good. Okay, if you maybe go back to the beginning of your career when you worked on some, some pretty big movies, Hollywood movies, Batman Begins, Thunderbirds, and The Brothers Grimm. Could you just tell me a little bit about what that was like and how you managed to sort of get on those movies?
Like a lot of people, I didn't know how to do in the film industry. I didn't have of people I knew that were connected. So I started out, so I did hear of this role called, you know, camera trainee, which I thought sounded amazing that you were paid to learn, you know, how the kind of camera department works. So after I graduated, I was really sort of just looking for any opportunity to get on a film set. And so I basically, you know, did lots of shorts like lots of other people do, like that were no pay and met camera crews through that. And then so one thing led to another that, you know, a DP was doing their first film and they asked me to trainee on it. And from there I met other crew. And so eventually I think that I did Batman Begins. I think that was about 2004. That was definitely, great film to be involved with. And so I'd been working with the same team because I was on the visual effects unit for that. And we had done Brothers Grimm together, and I think a few others. And so basically they got that, you know, the DP got that job and then he took his team with him and I was part of that team. So I was really, really fortunate to sort of get to do a run of, you know, of big films in quite a short space of time, which was obviously a great learning experience, seeing how things are done, at that level. and actually paid for me to, you know, kind of finance myself for much of NFTS, which I then sort of after, you know, at that point I was a second AC. And then I went to film school to do cinematography after that.
Sure. And then you were the recipient of the Freddie Francis Scholarship, is that right?
Yeah. I don't know if it's still the case now, but a lot of students at the NFTS were on some kind of form of scholarship that paid, you know, tuition fees or a large part of them. So I was really fortunate to get that for the 2 years that I was there. You know, it's amazing what the NFTS does to have basically 2 years to, you know, to learn and to try things out and to work with people. And because obviously I don't think you can appreciate it until you go into the working world as a DP, just how much of a gift it is to have that kind of gestation time to make stuff and to have, you know, to try things and have them, you know, not work and no one needs to see them and, you know, you're not being paid to do it. So you don't, you know, it doesn't ruin your reputation. So, so it was a really, yeah, it was something that I think I appreciate even more having left the film school, just quite the support and the resources that's there. So, I feel really, really grateful to the school and lucky that I got a place. Mm. So that was basically after having sort of been in the industry for about 3 odd years as a trainee and then stepping up to second. That was when I went to the NFTS.
Excellent. Yeah. And you were saying that I don't think you've got a family background in you know, cinema or wherever. So what were some of your earlier influences in terms of how you moved into the world of being a DP?
So I was doing a degree in English Lit and Theatre, and I was at the Fringe Festival volunteering one summer, and then I found out about the film festival that was, you know, in Edinburgh. And so I just sort of went to loads and loads of screenings and Q&As, and that was where I ended up, seeing, you know, like a talk about cinematography and realising, because actually at that point I thought I wanted to be a director. I didn't realise there was this role of cinematographer and that they were the one that was, you know, sort of responsible or more focused in terms of the visuals. And so that was where I sort of learned about that job. And then after that, I was quite sort of single-mindedly, that's what I want to do. And I think it was that same point I saw the film, The Ratcatcher, that Lynn Ramsey did. So that was quite instrumental. And then after that, saw out a lot of the work that Alwyn, you know, shot prior and subsequently. So that was, I think he was definitely a DP that was a big influence in terms of, I suppose actually I didn't appreciate it at the time, but I felt like he was doing quite contemporary, what now I think a lot of people follow, but those films that him and Lynn Ramsey did together were quite influential. And studying, I did a year studying film and photography as part of my undergrad degree, and that was where I had a great photography teacher and you know, like just devouring all these photography books that were in the university library. And so that was also quite, I suppose, because you're in your early 20s, or I think I was 21 at the time, and so everything is very, you know, when you discover a sort of new passion, then you really soak up everything that you can sort of, you know, around that. So it was quite a formative time in terms of photographers like discovering Nan Goldin and Philip Lortier de Corsia. And I loved a photographer called Dwayne Michaels, who's not really referenced in relation to cinema because he's more of a kind of concept photographer, but he does often present his work in a series of images that look a bit like a, you know, a film strip. So he mixes, you know, image and text. And so those were some people that I was interested in. But I was just so kind of green, I suppose, and coming to it quite late because so many DPs, you know, are shooting from much earlier age. And I really only got into photography sort of during that year. Like I'd taken stills before that and I always enjoyed it and I painted a lot, but I didn't ever, you know, I don't think it was, I didn't really know what I was doing with the camera. I think I was put off because I would get frustrated. I'd take pictures and they didn't turn out the way I wanted them to. I didn't have that technical knowledge. And it seems really strange now because nowadays with the internet, there's, you know, you could learn something. You can go on YouTube and you can you know, you can find out so quickly how to do things. Yeah. But, you know, like when I was in my late teens, that wasn't really in existence, or, you know, very much in its infancy. So there wasn't that whole wealth of knowledge that you could access so quickly. So kind of going about how you found out to do things sort of took a bit of a different process. So I think that is, it was a whole number of stuff. But yes, I think coming to it quite late, I was just kind of sort of, you know, tried to absorb as much as possible. Before that, I think it was mostly, yeah, like a lot of painting and drawing, which I did all throughout, you know, when I was at school and really enjoyed and sort of thought I might go to art school. But for whatever reason didn't. And it was, so it was great to sort of discover photography, because you could take an image, and if it didn't turn out, you could take another one. And it was very gratifying, you know, going into a dark room and developing prints. And so I suppose if you've done a lot of painting and drawing, it's a slow process. And then, you know, you mess it up right towards the end of the painting and you think, I've got to start over again. And so I quite like the immediacy of photography, when I started to do it. I don't know if that answers any of what you were asking.
No, that's fine. I was just interested as well as how as your career progressed, how you developed your approach as a cinematographer.
I think that's something that's still changing. Like, it's still developing, and I hope it always will, in a way, because I think that's helpful if you feel like you're not always just doing the same thing. And certainly there's, you know, like as technology is evolving, then the way that cinematographers do things is changing. But I suppose I generally come from, I do a lot of narrative, you know, so especially television drama in the last few years, more than, you know, music videos and commercials. So it's always coming from that story perspective, and how you can, you know, how you approach when you read a script, what you sort of see in your mind's eye, and how you convey that so that the audience hopefully have some kind of emotional response to the story in the way that I did when I first read it. So that's usually kind of what I filter my sort of thought process through. And I think probably, again, that really comes from that idea. It probably is influenced a lot from the years I spent at the NFTS, because that was, you know, narrative is kind of I think that's definitely the point that you're taught cinematography from at that school. At least it was when I was there. So it's usually that's the kind of story-led focus, and hopefully, you know, when you really feel the story and you know what the director had time to discuss stuff, then what you're naturally offering up, you know, on the day or in prep is kind of in harmony with the story that you're telling. You know, it's sort of got into your bones by that point. So yeah, that's generally my approach.
And do you find the advance of technology sometimes hinders as much as it benefits you, in terms of people always wanting to do more and more takes and that sort of thing?
I think it's certainly changed how we do things. Like the amount that you shoot on a typical day, and the ability to be able to, like, for example, something just like with LED lighting, how quickly you can change your color temperature rather than needing to, you know, gel your lights if you decide to do something different. Then that's great, having that flexibility. And certainly the ISOs of cameras now being incredible has pushed, you know, how much you can use available light in certain circumstances where you couldn't have done previously. So I think it's helpful. I think also comes with that a different, slightly different working practice and how you go about doing things. Certainly I shot on film recently, and so that took a bit of a shift in, not in approach in terms of lighting, but more in, you know, just the, I think because you don't have that, you can't just look at a monitor and go like, that's what I'm shooting. You have to think through the process, you know, sort of more, and check stuff more. Or maybe you don't, and that's just me, but that was kind of my, kind of going back to it after having had a good break from film. Then it was lovely, but it was also, you know, slightly terrifying again, because you don't have that comfort of knowing the image is there as you expect it to be.
I guess you've always got to be adaptable, haven't you, as you say, with, you know, going between sort of traditional techniques with film and then more modern techniques, I guess, as the digital cameras become more and more accepted.
Well, I mean, I think that they're the norm. It's not a case of them being accepted now, but certainly I think that adaptability is a really good thing for any DP to have, and not just technically, But in terms of your work, how you are on set and how you need to be with your director, because, you know, sometimes you don't know the directors you're working with very well before, you know, when you get the job, you just have a short call with them and, you know, or, you know, meeting. And I think part of that I find is trying to work out how they work and being able to work in a way that suits them. And that can be, you know, that can be really challenging if you have different ideas about how to do things. But that's what I mean, I suppose, about the approach to cinematography can't be something or doesn't, you know, I, not can't, but I would prefer that mine isn't something that's very rigid, because you, if you kind of open to different ways of working, you know, then it gives you different results. And I think that's, you know, that's interesting. And never assuming that you know, what the best way is to do it based on experience, because, I mean, you have an inkling, but I'm quite happy to be wrong about stuff. And then, you know, you end up with something that you didn't expect.
Right. Yeah, sure. And do you prefer to operate, or does it depend on the production? You know, some you operate on and some you don't.
Yeah, it definitely depends on the production. I think I've kind of come to feel, if it's single camera, I really enjoy operating. And I think that because I came from, you know, learning to light and operate so simultaneously, then it's quite hard to divorce the two. So there's a sort of control element, I suppose, in being able to operate that I quite enjoy. But I do think that when you go and do shoots with your two cameras, I'd almost prefer to operate neither, because then I can actually have a better idea of what's being shot. So it's really hard if you're in a situation where you're operating an A camera and you don't, you know, you're not able to very readily see how your lighting is on B, especially when you're shooting very quickly, you know, in a sort of drama situation. And there isn't necessarily, like, there's always this idea when people go, oh, I go back to the monitor and I check it. And I've never been in that situation, you know, so I end up sort of, you know, working off quite a small onboard monitor on my camera that I can get a feed from B just to kind of get a general idea. And obviously trusting the operator that they, that they're going to flag anything that doesn't look as good as it should in terms of, you know, lighting, if they see something during the take as it evolves that, you know, I wouldn't be happy with. So I think that's one that's a bit of a case by case, you know, situation.
Terrific. Moving on to Marcella, which actually this is another series that I watched, which I really enjoyed. Great cast, script and the cinematography. I thought it was quite terrific on it. Can you tell me a little bit about the background to how you came to shoot it?
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing sort of unusual. I got put forward for it and then I had a meeting and I, you know, got the job. So it wasn't, I didn't know Charles before. I did know the series before. So I was aware, you know, going in, it's the second series, and that there's a look that they wanted to continue because they felt it was very, you know, very strong, and it was very, you know, like it was a Scandi kind of drama, but set in London. It's had its own visual identity, and it really embraced quite strong colour. So it didn't want it to feel like something that was more desaturated. And so that definitely going into it, I knew, you know, from the first conversation I had with Charles that they were looking to, you know, continue that. So, but I think in season two, Charles wanted to sort of push the thriller element a bit more. And so there was we didn't shoot loads of handheld on that series. It was much more sort of track and dolly and so slow kind of creeping tracks in various locations. So I don't know whether that may be very little bit from the first season, but certainly it was working on that colour palette and you know, I think probably the biggest thing actually between the two, one and two, which was my kind of challenge to deal with, was that season one was shot in winter and we shot season two in summer, and so it was trying to find that darkness and that's the same mood and have the justification for this of the strong colour that had been there in the first season when it had been nighttime and there'd been lots of sodium and all that way that you sort of feel the presence of colour more in dark scenes. And so trying to be able to bring that in at every opportunity, even though we were shooting, you know, kind of in the daytime. I'm sorry, not in the daytime, you know, during summer. So that was the sort of challenge of that series.
Right. And I believe it was shot with a 2-to-1 aspect ratio.
Yeah.
Was that something that you pushed for, and what was the reason behind it?
I think I just was enjoying it at the time. And so the first season had been 16:9. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like a lot of DPs, it'd be nice to have shot, you know, 2-3-5. And that was, you know, that wouldn't have been allowed. But the 2-1 is, you know, has become increasingly popular, and it's very something that Netflix, you know, obviously I think everything they shoot is 2-1 or presented as 2-1. So I had a Netflix distribution. So it's something that I sort of suggested, and everyone was, you know, happy to go along with. So yeah, we did change that between the first and second season, and we shot with the same lenses. We kept with the P vintage that had been part of season one look, but I swapped the camera from the Sony to the Vericam 35. Yeah.
And what was the main reason behind the Vericam over, say, something like the Sony F65?
Well, it has to be 4K, you know, like that's, because mm-hmm. it's that Netflix delivery. So that was, you know, that was a big influencing factor in terms of what cameras I looked to test. And I liked the Vericam when I'd, you know, I felt like the Sony F65 was quite a big camera, and I knew that we were going to be shooting quite a lot of small domestic spaces in season two because of the storyline being slightly more domesticated. Mm-hmm. So that I wanted a slightly small, I wanted to get a camera, a smaller camera if I could. And it also could give you 4K, but with a, you know, like the, in the sort of the years subsequently, there'd been a, you know, a huge, obviously, advance in technology, as is always the way. And so you could shoot 4K with much smaller data. So that was also an influencing factor in terms of just making it, you know, more cost effective and slightly easier to manage all that data on set. So I really like the Panasonic Vericam because of the dual ISO, which I had tested and thought before, oh, this has got to be a gimmick. Actually was really impressed with, you know, like went out and did some tests, me and my focus puller, like sort of in East London, you know, parks at after dark, and was amazed by what you could get when you went to the higher ISO setting. So, and then, you know, we took it through to, we brought it into the grade and had a quick play around with it.
Yeah.
So it was useful to know that you had that in your back pocket if you needed to. And I think we did use it a few times, sometimes because I like to use a polar quite a lot of the time. So if you're in a dark scene and you're wanting to use that, then having that extra ISO, you know, meant that I could still keep using the polar when I wanted to.
Yeah. And does your approach to sort of pre-production testing, et cetera, change very differently to, you know, depending on the production? Or again, have you got a sort of a set routine that you always check and you always run through?
I think it's governed largely by time. You know, if you have only a very few weeks to prep for the start of a new series or your episode, then you don't want to spend a lot of time. At least I don't want to spend lots of time choosing choosing lenses or cameras, because I sort of want to focus on the script and have the time with the director and be able to see the locations and all that stuff, which, you know, obviously is critical. And so that I think that then I'd look to work with a camera or lenses that I already know what they're going to do and how they're going to behave, so that I can have that, you know, that basically I can focus my time on the actual story aspect of yeah. prep. So I think probably how much time you have is a large consideration. And also other things, like if you're going into a series where you've got a different requirement and the deliveries for the, you know, that you've not worked with before. Like if it was, I did something recently and we chose to shoot on a larger format, and I'd done a bit of testing before, but that was my first time sort of in earnest going into a drama, you know, with that. So sometimes if you're trying something, you know, there's more a technical aspect that you're embracing that you haven't before, then you need to obviously to focus on that to kind of get a handle of it. But I generally find that there's a similar process that sort of breaking down the script and sort of working out where I felt things when I read it, and therefore how we might try and show that for the audience. That doesn't tend to change.
No. I guess it's a balance, isn't it, as you said, between the, you know, the storytelling aspect and the technical aspect. And sometimes, I guess, you know, you can be sucked into the technical aspect too much. And, you know, particularly when manufacturers like to push different, you know, techniques and different, you know, boundaries in terms of what the sensor will do and you know, the frame rates and that sort of thing. So, as you say, it's not delving too far into the technical side at the detriment of the storytelling side.
Yeah, and I think for me, I'm not the most techie DP. I definitely prefer the creative, like that, the the time when you have to sit and think about the story and how that'll look, and the time with the director, that's the fun time, I think, for me. And the technical side is the, like, you know, when you're learning about what a sensor does, and that's more like the homework side of it. So so I always would prefer to have time to kind of indulge. But I mean, it's so rare that you get that. So it's always helpful then if you're working with a director that you've worked with before, because you already, you know, as everyone always says, you already have that history and that shorthand, and more that kind of bank of references, that of images or films or whatever it is that you both love. And so you can be very quickly, you know, talking through the script and going, oh yeah, like, do you remember that thing? And so you just have that set kind of common, there's a real reassurance obviously when you're working with someone who you know that you have a similar taste and sympathy, and that you naturally are going to sort of err towards the same stuff. So that always is nice when you've got that. Certainly, you know, it makes prep a lot faster. You know, you can cover more ground.
Yeah, I guess that am I right in saying that on the Amazon Prime series Hannah, that you actually worked with a director you'd worked with before?
Yeah, Amy and I had done Trust Me together, and so she got Hannah, and that was how I came to be involved. And yeah, I mean, Hannah was really fun. I mean, we didn't have, like, probably of the eight episodes, ours were again more sort of like the emotional content, a large part of the narrative around Hannah and sort of Marissa and her you know, relationship with her dad. And so we had a lot of kind of emotional punch in our two eps, and not as much sort of action stuff. Which, you know, we were kind of a little bit disappointed that we didn't get to do more stuff kind of running around, sort of blowing things up the way the other apps did. But it did allow us to concentrate a bit more on that sort of emotional, you know, obviously we concentrated on the emotional sort of journey of the characters at this point. And that was, again, sort of leading those decisions. So, yeah, it's lovely working with the director that you've worked with before. It just, and it's just that trust, and that they're going to sort of give you that space and freedom to do your thing. And you obviously, you know, respect what they need to do, so you kind of have that immediate, just a quicker way of kind of how you approach stuff.
Yeah, and did you again follow the house style, right, or from the original movie, or the house style from the TV series?
Not at all. Like, there was the film was its own thing, and so I mean, David Farr, who is the writer and executive on the series, was also the writer on, and probably the executive as well, on the original film. So you know, there was obviously that, you know, that was there, but I think they were quite happy and interested in taking it away from, you know, it doesn't have so many fantastical elements to it in the TV series. It's much more kind of grounded in a reality, and so I think that there wasn't ever any comparison or any discussion about the film in relation to the series. So yeah, that there wasn't that crossover. And in terms of the sort of house style of the series, because our episodes, you know, so 5 and 6 were quite different. They had their own locations. They weren't, you know, in the forests, and or at least not in the forest that you see at the beginning of episode 1. And so definitely we didn't have that, and you have to do it a certain way, because the first, you know, the pilot episode that Dana Gonzalez shot, you know, so wonderfully, that was quite a different style to sort of block 2. So when I came on block 3, it was very much like we were told, you know, just to tell the story, and we'll trust that the style that comes out of that is, you know, is fine type thing. We kind of jumped between handheld and sort of more stylized stuff, and we weren't, you know, we weren't super aware of how the other episodes had been, you know, been telling the story. But obviously there's always going to be a continuity if you've got, you know, the same colorist did the whole grade, and we had the same lenses, and we had the same cameras, and we had the same crew. And so there's, you know, there's an element of that that kind of helps keeping everything in line. But because we you know, we were in different locations, different countries, there wasn't that need to light something in the same way that they'd done it in the previous, you know, episodes.
Sure. And you mentioned about the action scenes, but I think I'm right in saying at the end of episode 6, there was a helicopter.
Yeah, I mean, we did have some action. It wasn't that it was completely devoid. It just wasn't. Yeah, we had a chase sequence that culminated with a helicopter sort of taking off and the shootout. And so, yeah, there was that. And there's some other sort of chase sequences, but they weren't as, you know, they maybe weren't as big as the ones in the other episodes.
Yeah.
But no, the helicopter stuff was great fun. So, yeah, like that was fun thing to prep for as well. You know, me and Amy going to the airfield and just kind of playing around at the different angles and what we could achieve from the ground without the helicopter, you know, needing to be in the air and therefore use the real actors and what stuff had to be green screened. And so, that was a fun sequence to shoot. But again, Hannah's obviously, you know, had a huge push by Amazon, which was wonderful, and it's been a really successful series. And obviously, as they're making the second series now, so it had it's been wonderfully well received, which is great. But you, when you're on a kind of new series, you don't necessarily know if it's going to go, you know, how it's going to go down. So you're just kind of quietly getting on with it, and it feels like it has more scale in retrospect than we necessarily had on the day. Like I remember doing that sequence; that was just the morning's work. The part involving the helicopter and the shootout, we were at an unused airport in Budapest, and we had three other scenes inside the airport and a dialogue scene in a car to shoot, you know, sort of in the afternoon. So it definitely was quite a fast shoot, that one.
Mm. Did you have any experience of green screen and action in some other productions you can talk about?
Everything, like the screen, you know, green screen is always popping up on sort of most shoots that you do. And so, like, that's been part of something that, you know, I remember we learned how to do green screen workshop stuff at the NFTS. And then it's always been part of sort of working as a DP that you have that, you know, you have that skill set.
Yeah.
And I think, if anything, it feels like it's less of a limitation than it used to be, because of the kind of ground that's been made in the last sort of 10, 15 years. So it isn't the same. Yeah, it doesn't give you the restrictions that maybe it used to.
Yeah.
So that's really, really good. Certainly, we had a bit of green screen in Hannah, not huge amounts, but the stuff where Joel Kinnaman, who plays Hannah's father, Eric, you know, where he's obviously in the helicopter piloting up in the air, that was obviously done from the ground. I was involved in some of Game of Thrones last year, and a large part of what we were shooting on that was green screen, and that was from previous. It was the battle sequence in episode three, so that had large amounts of green screen. But I think that now you don't have to approach it differently than you're lighting what you need to, and then you sort of take care of the green screen as necessary. So it doesn't feel like it's a big restriction the way it perhaps was.
Sure. Can you just briefly talk us through how you shot one of your favourite scenes in Hannah?
I'm just thinking, what's my favourite scene? I think probably one of my favourites, I just enjoyed it for it. Its kind of simplicity was, there's the scene where Eric gets shot, which I think is towards the end of episode five. That was a fun one. You know, we kind of looked at a few locations when we were blocking it. And certainly when you read it in the script, it came out of nowhere that they're just in the middle of this sort of average conversation, not average conversation. that would be a huge insult to David. They're in a very kind of domestic conversation. And then, it's Eric that gets captured. It's his colleague that gets shot dead, and it's out of nowhere. And so we definitely, when we went to approach that, we wanted it to feel like, for the same thing for the audience, that it's quite unexpected, and that that we weren't sort of suddenly changing the style of how we'd been shooting our episodes to accommodate the action, that we wanted it to feel very much like it was still in that same language. So that was one that was fun, because we decided that we'd sort of try and shoot it as much as possible in one single take. So we kind of blocked it out and rehearsed it. And I think we did sort of five or six takes on it, and it was all done with a Ronin being run with by two very, very fit grips that were able to kind of run at speed and matching, you know, Joel's pace as he sort of sprints, you know, across this little kind of park area and into a house. And so that was quite a fun one to do. And we had actually got, I think we had our, we sort of planned for three cameras that day, you know, because it was this part of action, and there was all these different sort of stuff that we spotted and we shot some of. But when we saw how well this worked as one, we were like, there's no way you want to cut into it. So happily, you know, we'd done a couple of the other sort of aerial shots and some other interesting ones that were nice shots, but happily we didn't end up, you know, both Amy and I were kind of keen that it stayed as one, and I was delighted that, you know, when that was the most of what happened in the edit, apart from some kind of scripted POV shots that had to be separate. But yeah, that was a fun one to do. I enjoyed a lot of that show, and sometimes it's just the simple things that you enjoy shooting, because I think that's always nice. I always feel satisfied when you've been able to quite elegantly cover a scene without you know, excessive amount of coverage, that you feel there's been a commitment to how you've covered it on the day in camera and how you've told the story, rather than, you know, sort of 20 odd setups and then leaving it all to the edit to how it gets paced. But then that said, there's some shows that really lean into that and other shows where that just wouldn't be the way to go. And you mentioned Press earlier, which was a series that I shot that was very, very dialogue heavy, you know, pretty much all in offices and, you know, lots and lots of 2-3-handers in, you know, in interior spaces. And that was one where we did do a lot of coverage because of just, you know, wanting to be able to pace things in the edit in a way that meant, I guess, you're just enabling, you know, to make sure you had the best performance. So that's a different example where, you know, going for minimal coverage wouldn't have really helped the show.
Sure. Talking about Press, you were the series DP on that. Could you explain how that differs from a production like Hannah, where you did a couple of episodes?
Yeah. Well, I think it's really great when you get to do a series, because you you sort of have more ownership over it because you're doing the whole thing. But obviously it's great to set something up and be, you know, having the freedom to make those choices around your lenses and your camera and bring on the crew that you love working with. And so that's always really great. But I think it's more the sense that if you're doing the whole thing, you go, right, well, this is a sort of 6-hour story that we're telling. And so it's you kind of can approach it. You feel like it's more like a long film, rather than if you're doing 2 episodes and it's in the middle of a series, then you don't have the same understanding of the, you know, the episodes either side, because you haven't shot them. Obviously you've read them or you've watched assemblies if, you know, if you come into it later on, but that it isn't in your, it's kind of not in you the same way that when you've, you know, when you've gone through all the scenes and you know them inside out. So it's really nice to have that continuity across the series. So I suppose that's kind of the main difference, that it feels like, well, it is, you know, you're kind of watering the whole thing in terms of what the cinematographer does. So, you know, that's a great sort of responsibility and joy to get to do that.
Sure. Does that bring extra pressure, or is it pressure that you sort of enjoy the fact that, as you say, you've got all the decisions to make and it is your baby, if you like, the whole series?
Yeah, I think there is that pressure, because you're starting off and people are always understandably very concerned about the pilot episode, because, you know, if people don't enjoy that, they're not going to stick with the series. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressure on doing a pilot, and things get scrutinized much more than, you know, if you're doing like the middle block in the series. You know, like your choices, sometimes you have to explain your choices to a huge number of people, you know, and show a lot of visual material about how basically you're kind of needing to reassure people before you've shot anything of exactly how it's going to look. So, you know, that can be time consuming and at times tricky, because obviously you can hunt around and try and show as much as possible as to what you have in your mind's eye. But there's always just something that evolves when you start shooting, that you can have talked about things in prep and what you want to do. And then, you know, like quite quickly you see that that on certain, like I always find if I'm on when I start something, you quickly feel which lenses become the 2 or 3 lenses that you're always on, because it feels like it's right for the character or the, you know, the actor's face or the style. And that sort of tends to then be what you, you know, how you sort of shoot the series. And so sometimes you can have an idea about something and it becomes very apparent, you know, halfway through day two that isn't what the material needs. And yeah. So something else is born out of, you know, what you're doing. And so I suppose you can always try and, with the best will in the world, show exactly what you're going to do. But there is an element of when all the actors come together and you're in the real locations, the performers, obviously that's the most important thing, that's going to change. So, But I mean, as long as everyone still is happy, I've never had it, even though things do change, touch wood, it's been, you know, people have been happy with the results that have been in the dailies, so it's been okay. But yes, I think that you do have more pressure when you're doing a pilot, but it's, you know, it's great to have that chance to, you know, to do something that is, you know, that is as you saw it. So,
yeah. I mean, in terms of the series, of, you know, the series, what were the biggest challenges, would you say, that you faced, you know, trying to replicate? Obviously, there's two, you know, newspapers. One's the Post and one's the Herald, and how you differentiate between the two camps, if you like. And
yeah, I mean, that was a big part of, you know, like, in, that was a big discussion during pre-production, because we spend so much time in the offices, so it needed to be immediately apparent which office you're in, so, you know, that the audience didn't have to sort of, you know, think about that too much. So, but that was wonderfully done by the designer, in a large part, in terms of the two colour palettes having quite a different feel. Like, there's, you know, there's sort of the Herald is much more organic, like sort of softer materials, slightly softer colour palette, and the you know, more natural, there's more wood in that space. And as a result, I did slightly softer lighting, and it was more lighting kind of coming in through windows, whereas in the, sort of kind of all keeping that tied in. And then in the Post, it was much more of a, it was a faster office. It had a sort of different dynamism. And so we tried to have the camera move a bit more there. I mean, the colour palette was much more garish. It was much more, there's a really strong red. It was very, very saturated, very sort of punchy, and I was generally lighting from above, so the lighting was more oppressive and, you know, not as flattering. And so that was kind of what I did in terms of sort of doing something slightly different with the lighting style that hopefully complemented what was being done with the design. And then we sort of had a slightly different feel in the offices in terms of what the camera did. Like, that's again, like, the, you know, we're on slightly different wider lenses in the Herald, as we, and then sort of slightly of mid-range when we were in the other way around, the Herald had the mid-range and the Post was much wider lenses, so that was kind of the differentiation of helping establish those two different worlds. But I kind of always feel like you don't want to do it to, at least I feel that it's quite nice to do it in a way that hopefully the audience aren't really aware of, that they can feel that it feels like it works, but maybe they're not having to be, you know, that the cinematography isn't calling attention to itself of, you know, this is what we've done and we've really manipulated you to feel a certain way.
Yes, you don't want to be waving a big flag, do you, and saying that these are the goodies and these are the baddies.
Yeah, exactly. And also, and I don't feel like reading the script, you know, you kind of go into it in the beginning thinking that sort of, that there's a, but as the series progresses in the discussion about, you know, kind of how news gets created and, well, created from fake news and how it gets spread and whether the ends justifies the means, if what you're doing is good, then the means to be able to get it out to the people, you know, can be a bit of a grayer area. So that was something that I think was quite keen from the director and writer, that it didn't feel like this really obviously judgmental world where one's clearly left wing and the other one's, you know, very much like the kind of the right wing tabloids that you don't want to side with. So it was trying to help there be a bit of that the audience aren't, there's a balance, I suppose, between them.
And do you get quite a kick out of when someone tells you about a series or something you've shot?
I think it's lovely when someone said, "Oh, I saw that and I enjoyed it." You know, I don't like that's. I feel like you've done a good job if people have, you know, wanted to watch it and, you know, stuck with the series and enjoyed it. And it's lovely, yeah, when friends message and say, you know, tell you which episode they're watching and you know, as they, yeah, so no, that's really always the nicest thing, I think, especially because now there's so much on television and, you know, with everything that's available to stream and you know, that it really is, if someone does watch, you know, like a sit down and watch the whole series, and that's, you know, a great kind of commitment. Well, it's a commitment of their time when there's so much else they could be watching, so that's always really nice to hear.
And do you enjoy, I guess you travel an awful lot in different countries, etc. Do you enjoy that element of it?
Yeah, I do. I really like to film in different places. I like traveling, so I suppose that's a good part. I think probably most DPs do enjoy traveling. I mean, it can be hard if you're away sort of from home for a while for sustained periods, because you know, is your life ultimately, and if you're in another country for months on end, you sometimes question that. But I do enjoy it. I think it's because when you go to another country and you're in a different environment, like visually, it's quite stimulating. So it gives you new ideas because you're seeing things with fresh eyes. And then you come back to the UK and you haven't been there for a while, and you then again, it kind of has a refresh about how you sort of see stuff. So, and just the joy of going to new places and meeting new people and seeing how things are done in different parts of the world, that never fails to sort of excite me. So I love it when I get the chance to travel with work. Just because you just see new things. So when I get sent material that's potentially shooting in another country, then that usually just makes me slightly biased towards it. But also then when I'm there, I go like, why did I choose this? You know, often you don't have your team with you, because that's usually the requirement when you go, that you're using local crew, and that, you know, and that's absolutely, you know, as it should be. But sometimes, like, not having your own gaffer, you know, or your own grip, or like the people that you really dependent upon, you know, to understand how you like to work, then that can, you know, especially if you're in a country and they don't have, you know, you've got the language barrier sometimes, then that can make for like a level of stress that is definitely not always welcome. So it comes with goods and bads, but I think ultimately the fact that I keep on choosing to do projects abroad means that, you know, the kind of the excitement of the new wins out.
Too. And is there any genre that you either haven't done or you'd like to do more of?
I'd love to do like a road movie, you know, a big road movie that just, I love shooting in landscapes, and I grew up in Scotland, just near Loch Lomond. And I think that having had that as a, just what you see, you know, through your childhood, these big mountains, and that's where I just feel happiest. And so I'd love to do a movie or a TV series that allowed me to just be in huge, big spaces. So some kind of road movie or a Western, then that would be really, really exciting to get to do that sort of genre.
Terrific. Well, Kate, that's been fantastic. And, you know, thanks for joining us today and talking about your career on the Visual Impact podcast. I'm very much appreciated.
Thanks very much for having us. Thank you.
That was award-winning cinematographer Kate Reid, BSc, talking about her career highlights. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcasts, blogs, and exclusive Visual Impact content by going to our website, visuals.co.uk.